From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Emmy nominations are out and HBO is back on top. Then artist Terry and Joe Harvey Allen look back at more than 50 years of marriage and making art and music together.
I was on Chindig in 1965 and I sang Redbird, and it might be the only footage in America of somebody playing a kazoo with girls screaming.
Because Terry was so cute.
And we introduce you to singer-songwriter J.S. Ondara, who was so inspired by Bob Dylan's music, he moved to Minnesota from Kenya. All that coming up on The Frame. The Emmy nominations were announced this morning, and once again, the pay cable channel HBO collected the most nominations, thanks in part to this show.
Go on.
I don't know how to ride a dragon.
Nobody does until they ride a dragon.
Yes, the final season of Game of Thrones got a record number of nominations today. There were some notable snubs, and some series, like the new season of Big Little Lies, didn't fall into the eligibility calendar. And in some categories, especially comedy, Emmy voters did not cast a very diverse net. Lorraine Olley is the TV critic at the LA Times, and she joined me today to talk about the nominations. We started with why Game of Thrones got so much attention, even if most people thought the past season wasn't exactly that good.
First off, yes, there's so much love for Game of Thrones, and it was the weakest of 8 seasons. I feel like it ended kind of with a meh instead of a bang. But, you know, it's the last season, so it was almost predictable that Emmy voters were going to pile on that one. What was unpredictable is that it was going to get like 32 nominations, which is this record-breaking, you know, for any program ever in one season. I think it broke NYPD Blue's record.
It did.
And that's 25-year-old record.
So 26 nominations in 1994. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is important, because HBO made Game of Thrones, HBO led all the networks with 137 nominations ahead of Netflix, which had beaten HBO last year for like the first time, I think, in 17 years. Netflix still did pretty well with 117. And we should say it's not just Game of Thrones that's driving HBO. They also did really well with some series like Chernobyl. I mean, there's a lot of depth to their nominations this year.
There is. And you know what's really interesting about Chernobyl? Not only is it excellent, and it is an excellent, but it's a limited series, right? And the limited series category this year has got some of the strongest contenders of any category, and which is unusual because you have like When They See Us, Chernobyl, Escape from Dannemora. But Chernobyl particularly came in something like fourth in the number of nominations. For a limited series, that's kind of astounding.
Third. It was third. Game
was
of Thrones was,
wow.
was most. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was second. Chernobyl was third with 19 nominations. So
see, you know, everybody loves a nuclear meltdown. Really?
Who doesn't?
I mean, what says entertainment more than that, really?
Why are these awards important, or the nominations? Because a ton of money was spent on promotions. There are all these four-year consideration events. It has become its own nuclear meltdown in terms of spending. Does it actually pay off?
Well, I know I get tons of stuff at work, just like really great, ridiculous crap, but I don't vote, so I don't know why they're wasting money on me. I do think those campaigns work. Think about it in terms of the Oscars. You know, all the politics. I mean, it's like any campaign, right? The more that you can push sway, the better operators you have with you, the better campaign managers, the more likely you are to like end up at least on the nominations, if not winning. And I do think it makes a difference.
No, and I think it does. I don't know that they can change your mind, but they can certainly be a finger on the scale if you're, you know, considering A versus B and remind you why you might really like a series.
Right. And I'm wondering, When They See Us might be an example of that. It's excellent. But I do think there was some heavy campaigning for that, and it showed here, because people were thinking that might be the thing that got snubbed, and people were really passionate about it. But the passion of viewers does not drive the nomination.
Obviously, there's some big shows like Veep and Game of Thrones that are going away, and it's hard to even look past this year's Emmy ceremony to figure out where the future lies. But it does feel like there's some new series that are getting a lot of attention. Russian Doll, Dead to Me. Do you start to see some shows that are really starting to rise up as other shows that have been around for a while and been very critically acclaimed and won a lot of trophies start to go away.
You know, Veep, of course, is satire about politics, hysterically funny, Game of Thrones fantasy. But I think what we're seeing in what's ahead or what's rising up now is a darker sort of comedy, some comedies or dramas underpinned by a lot more realism. When They See Us, about the Central Park Five, also came in very high, a limited
16,
series.
16 right. nominations.
And heavy-duty material, you know, about these five young men who were wrongly convicted and spent decades in jail for that assault and rape in Central Park in 1989. That being in the top tier was something as whimsical as The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and as Game of Thrones. That kind of tells you something. That's the newcomer, right?
Yeah, and I would say Russian Doll, definitely somewhat darker. So does that mean that the Television Academy is embracing darker material? Because obviously, if you start looking really closely, there are not a lot of fun comedies that are getting multiple nominations right now, outside maybe Veep, but most of the stuff is pretty dark.
We're not in fun times. I think it's kind of reflecting what we need to see, what we need to laugh at. And things are kind of dark right now. So, and I would even argue that The Good Place, which isn't particularly a dark show, it deals with like death, essentially, what happens after you die.
And about morality and how you live your life. And
exactly.
If you make the right choices, if you treat others well. Along the same lines, I think it's worth noting that Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which had 9 nominations among all of the late night shows, and I know he's only on once a week as opposed to every night, certainly probably the most biting political commentary I think you could find on television right now.
Exactly. And he tends to focus and deep dive, right? And some of these shows that we're talking about kind of have that depth. If you're looking at The Good Place, like you're saying, morality, all of those issues are in there. It's not just a, like a fun broadcast comedy. It's got depth to it. And many of these things that you're seeing on the list, I think we're choosing stuff that means a little bit more. Even if it does make us laugh, and even if we do want to escape with it a little, I think it has a little more resonance to the times right now.
I think we can agree that a lot of edgier, darker material was recognized in the Emmy nominations. But what does it tell us about where TV can go and get better in terms of inclusion, in terms of experimentation? Where do you see potential progress?
I see progress in what we're looking at in terms of women. A lot of the programming here is either female-centric in terms of the story, the cast, the showrunners. The push to have more women behind the camera has probably been more successful in television than in terms of getting more people of color. And I think it's just going to take a long time because some of the stuff we see bubbling up, Rami, One Day at a Time's coming back, all of those things have potential moving forward.
Lorraine Ollie is the TV critic for the LA Times. Lorraine, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, Terry and Joe Harvey Allen tour his current retrospective that reflects their 50 years of making art together. In the early 1960s, Terry and Joe Harvey Allen got married in their hometown of Lubbock, Texas. They soon came to Los Angeles, where he attended Chouinard Art Institute and she hosted a country radio show right here in Pasadena. Terry became known in the outlaw country scene with albums such as Juarez and Lubbock on Everything, which were accompanied by visual art and theater works. Meanwhile, Joe Harvey acted in plays and performance art pieces. A new retrospective called Terry Allen, The Exact Moment It Happens, is up now at the LA Louvre Gallery in Venice. The Allens recently walked through the show and reminisced about their time in LA. They started with how long they've been married.
57 years in July. But we met when we were 11.
But we didn't until we were 12.
My name's Joe Harvey, and my last name is Allen.
I'm Terry Allen. And we're in my exhibition at LA Louvre.
And this first body of drawings here from 1966. Terry was working in his studio at our little house on Beechwood Drive, and I was working at the telephone company on Western Boulevard. And Terry said, "Well, I think I'm going to illustrate the Bible now." And I was so impressed. And I told everybody at the phone company, "He's doing the Bible now." And then I saw the drawings and I didn't know. Well, you'll have
Which
to come
Bible
to the,
was he talking about?
You have to come to the gallery. It's hard
Looks like
to
the Bible
describe.
To me.
There's a sleight of hand with a deck of cards behind it. There's some women's underwear that doesn't have the crotch in it, just holds for the...
Fredericks of Hollywood.
Yeah. And there's tubes coming out of the nipples. You know, I think it'd be hard to find exact scriptures to match the images.
Hold down, down, hold down, D. Redbird dancing in custody.
Redbird's the first song. I wrote it in about 1962. It's the first real song I thought I actually had written. You know, all the songs I'd written before that were pretty much written to be thrown out of high school, which I achieved. But Redbird I wrote in one of our first places here. And then a couple of years later, I was working in construction in Hollywood Hills, and I was waiting for my check, and I sat down at the piano and started playing that song. And this guy came up to me and he said, "How would you like to be on Shindig?" Kind of variety rock and roll show.
From ABC Television Center in Hollywood, Shindig.
So I said, sure, you know, and I tried out for it. And I was on Shindig in 1965, and I sang Redbird. But I played a kazoo, and it might be the only footage in America of somebody playing a kazoo with girls screaming.
Because Terry was so cute. Yes. Oh my God. Someone tapped me on the shoulder after that show and said, "Hey, I want to get in contact with this guy. You obviously know him the way you're screaming as well." And he said that he was the Beatles manager, and I just told Terry, "Let's borrow $500 because we're going to be rich on Monday." And we borrowed $500 from the man that Terry was working for and went to Laguna Beach to celebrate our good fortune, but we never got the call.
Yeah.
Yes, so there ought to be a law against sunny Southern California.
All throughout the show, there's, because I have always played music and made visual art, and I've always thought of them as one thing, but this is the first time, I think, in any gallery situation that they've really set up a situation where you can hear the music, you can see the work, and get a sense of the totality of it. So it's not only records that are playing or pieces of records, but we did a radio show in Pasadena called Rawhide and Roses in the 60s. There's a segment from that show.
Hi, this is Joe Harvey Allen bringing you a little Rawhide and Roses. Right on your corner, left at your heart, and straight on your way home.
You know, I didn't know a thing about doing anything. And you can tell when you listen to those radio shows, because I say things like, "Oh, those truckers, they're just, you know, they're hungry. They get to go in and eat at the truck stops, and they see beautiful things on the road."
And I think it's really great that country people dedicate so many songs to the truck driver. Here's a really great song called "White Line Fever" by Merle Haggard.
White Line Fever.
And they were all theme shows. They were like the one that's here is Honky Tonks, but all the songs and everything related to Honky Tonks. Then it would do Animals, would do Illicit Love, you know.
And we would travel around the country and interview people. I mean, we'd go to the snake farm and interview the snake man, or we would do these shows. And we just had so much fun. It was a popular show just because it was unique. And also, I don't think anyone had heard a woman, and especially a woman who just rattled on about my crazy family, and interview people all day.
You remind me how fast I'm growing old.
Well, this is Ring. This is a story about this couple who were both writers and alcoholics, and kind of the dissolution of a marriage. And all of the metaphors connected to it had to do with wrestling.
I am me, and you are you. And if along the way we find one another, it's beautiful.
In this piece, I wore a mask. In the Ring piece, I loved that feeling of performing and losing myself and getting to be someone else. And really, Terry's pieces all along, he's always had me perform them. They're so beautiful. It's been such a great honor for me to get to be in his works.
He came from a family of sports promoters. She was with him.
Yeah, my dad was a pro ball player, but he was like 60 when I was born, so he wasn't playing much ball at that time. And started throwing dances, and eventually got a promotership and started having wrestling matches, and did Golden Glove stuff. Years later, I was doing this piece in Houston, and I had to go to the wrestling promoter in Houston and get to get a ring and to get wrestlers. But I remember going into his office, and it totally reminded me of my dad, because it had all these little trophies and, you know, photographs of him with midget wrestlers. And it wasn't until kind of we really started rehearsing that it dawned on me I was doing exactly what my dad had done, you know.
Producing,
I was putting on this,
putting
on this wrestling match for an audience and whatever. And it kind of, to me, that's what happens when you make art, that, you know, you kind of circle back into yourself all different. I think those kind of loops have happened all throughout the show, and kind of, you know, as far as personal incidences, synchronicity, whatever.
And she read his latest letter. It said, never again would leave her alone. And beside it, the telegram.
This piece I especially like because it's talking about where songs come from.
Yeah, the piece is it's called Memoirs, and it's M-E-M-W-A-R-S. One of the walls is the music. The other two are the talking heads of Joe Harvey and I telling these stories and listening to one another.
But it's stories that we've experienced over all these years, and the stories about people and events that have led to specific songs.
In all of her fear.
1967, my friend Stanley was killed in Vietnam by a landmine. He was from Hobbs, New Mexico, had crazy pinwheeling eyes, loved Coors in the can, and dipped snuff.
They called him the Roadrunner. I'm not sure, but I think he still holds some kind of records.
What was surprising to me was when they were filming it and they were right in our faces, because these are huge projections. But you can see all of our wrinkles and our gray hair and our aging. And I at first thought, oh dear, I'm letting them shoot close up like this. When I saw it, I absolutely loved it. I have nothing but excitement really about the age. And I think it's really a gift to be able to see all of the flaws that have happened to you over, and the marks, and it seems beautiful to me that we've been blessed to live this long and still work together, and you know, it's just been a joy.
That segment was edited by Jonathan Shiflett. Terry Allen's exhibit is at the L.A. Louvre Gallery through September 28th. Coming up on The Frame, singer-songwriter J.S. Ondara. The Current is an all-music public radio station in St. Paul, Minnesota. It's part of American Public Media, which also operates KPCC. The Current hosts in-studio interviews and performances with up-and-coming musicians, and our colleagues are sharing some of those sessions with us. We launch our collaboration with J.S. Ondara. He's a singer-songwriter from Kenya who became so taken with the music of Bob Dylan that he packed up and moved from Africa to his hero's home state of Minnesota.
There was no way I was going to be able to do what I'm doing now, to become a folk singer around there with the people that were around me, for starters, because, you know, they wouldn't let me. The culture there does not really put enough precedence on arts, and that sort of mentality spills over into family structures and all that. So, you know, I had a lot of pressure just not to pursue music. And I sort of felt like I needed to be somewhere different where I could find ears for what I was trying to do. I think because of the sort of lack of emphasis on the arts, that ends up becoming a problem in the society in such a way that it doesn't provide an infrastructure for careers in arts to excel. So there's a lot of layers of reasons, but, you know, I think I had it set in my head that I had to leave. I had to go. I love my home, but I had to leave so I could, you know, to this. I'm just getting good at saying goodbye. Getting good at saying goodbye. Getting good. You know, as a boy, you dream about things. You know, it's what you do. You dream about flying spaceships. You dream about going on a date to the moon, or, you know, flying to an alternate universe. It's just what you do as a boy. So I dreamt about all that, and then I also dreamt about moving to America and making a record called Tales of America, just as a foolish dream as a boy. He was just an American dream. He was just an American dream. Somehow, you know, through just a series of strange events, one thing leading to the next, that part of my foolish dreaming has come to fruition in some bizarre way. He was just an American dream. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, my mom would give me money to go to school, and I, you know, like a bus fare, and instead of going to school, I'd just go to the internet cafe and just consume music. Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? Growing up listening to all this Bob Dylan, it felt like I was in a spaceship and I was traveling to a completely different universe where everyone spoke a different language, everyone, you know, looked different, they sounded different, they did different things. It was a spaceship. That's what music was for me as a child, and it transported me to somewhere. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. As the internet became a thing and I started spending all my days on the internet instead of going to school, sorry, Mom, the idea of what a success in music could be was forming at that point, when I could see performances of, you know, people performing online and thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe I could do that. Maybe. Who knows? Maybe. When you're in different places outside of America and you're thinking about America, you don't necessarily think of New York or LA, you just think of America because it's this huge place that you see on TV. And since I was in high school and I was discovering Dylan, and I was like, okay, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to move to Minnesota, and I think I'm going to try to start a career in music. And so the first thing I did was apply to the University of Minnesota, tried applying to, you know, jobs and everything, tried everything really, nothing really ever worked until it did, just by pure chance at some point, like when I'm about to give up. The whole journey to come into America, it was just impossible. Will you let me in? It ended up being just a thing of putting one foot in front of the next, you know, learning the guitar, started putting all these poems and stories I was writing into melodies, and, you know, got out there, started playing these songs. As soon as I could, I figured out a few chords, and this is it. This is what I came here to do. It's precisely this, is to tell stories and to travel around the world telling them. So it's just moving on. It's just another record, another batch of stories. And, you know, hopefully by telling stories and, you know, sort of communing with people through that in live shows, hopefully make some kind of, you know, positive influence on people's lives, or, you know, just the general society and civilization.
Oh, God bless America.
J.S. Ondara's debut album, Tales of America, is available on streaming services. You can hear more of that session at thecurrent.org. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn in the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC. Join us back here tomorrow.
Will you let